Northwestern University, in cooperation with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents The Reviewing Stand. Today, The Reviewing Stand asks, what's behind the Egyptian crisis? Our unrehearsed give-and-take discussion will present an analysis of the conflict between England and Egypt and the implications for America. Now, our moderator, James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, will introduce participants in today's discussion. Mr. McBurney.
Our speakers today are Leslie Nichols of the WGN News staff here in Chicago, Charles Mault, Associate Professor of British History at the University of Chicago, William McGovern, Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University, and Hussein Kamel Saleem, Professor of Economic History and Dean of the School of Commerce at the Fouad University in Cairo, Egypt. Gentlemen, what's behind the Egyptian crisis? Professor Saleem, how would you answer that?
Well, I think the present trouble can be summed up in one sentence. It's patriotism, nationalism that has been kept waiting too long, and that has finally gone beyond waiting. It can all be settled by just recognizing the right of Egypt to be free.
Maud, what would you say?
Well, of course, Britain quite agrees with Egypt's right to be free. The difference comes in method. Britain, at this moment, at this juncture of circumstances, is reluctant to turn over to Egypt the responsibility for the defense of the canal zone and the responsibility for the administration of the Sudan.
Precisely, Mawat, what is Britain's position?
Well, I'll speak first to the Sudan question so that we can return to what I think is the more important one of the defense of the canal zone. In the Sudan, Britain would deny that Egypt has long historic position. It was only in the 19th century that the Sudan came under Egyptian control. That ended with the revolt in 1884-85, culminating in the massacre at Khartoum. The Sudan was reconquered, largely by British forces, with a very few Egyptian soldiers taking part, in 1899. The joint administration, which in effect has been the British administration, certainly completely since 1924, dates from that event.
Now, what is the British position so far as the Sudan area is concerned?
The British position is that Sudan is an area distinct from Egypt as far as its people, its languages, and the religion of many of them is concerned, that there has grown up there a sound administrative system, a great increase in the economic welfare of the country, considerable increase in education and health facilities, that recently Britain and unfortunately, without being able to get Egyptian agreement on the matter, set up a legislative assembly in 1948. Now it proposes, following the agreement of a constitutional commission, to give to the Sudan complete self-government. That is a two-chamber parliament and a cabinet this very year. The British position is that then the Sudanese should decide for themselves on the principles of self-determination what they want to do, whether to become completely independent or to join with the Sudan, with Egypt in some future status.
Now, McGovern, what is America's stake in this?
Of course, obviously, we have no direct concern with Sudan one way or the other. Though I do agree with Professor Mowat here, and that is, if we are concerned with the principles of self-determination, which in general is the American position, there seems to be no reason that the Sudan should either go to England or go to Egypt. That, as Mowat has pointed out here, that the connections between the Sudan and the Egyptian are comparatively modern. It was only under Muhammad Ali's time in the 19th century that Egypt conquered temporarily the Sudan, but her background, her traditions, the race of the Egyptians and the race of the Sudanese is completely different. There are in the Sudan a great many different tribes, but nearly all of them are Negroid in character. It doesn't mean they're better or worse, but they're different in character from the Egyptians. The only common there is Mohammedanism. But as a matter of fact, many of the Sudanese tribes are not even Mohammedan, and the type of Mohammedanism is different from that of Egypt. Therefore, from the point of view of, as an impartial outsider, we would say here that we would like to see Sudan grow up into an independent nation. The only thing, of course, I think we can go back a little bit further, McBurney, and that is, I think, that as Nichols has pointed out, the whole thing is largely a question of psychology. There's a boiling up nationalism which is blown off its head. We've got to realize that Egypt has not really been governed by Egyptians since 500 B.C. They've been governed, first of all, by the Persians, and then by the Greeks, and by the Romans, and then by the Arabs, and then by the Mamelukes, and then by the Turks. And actually, even the present ruling family of Egypt and the present ruling classes in Egypt are the descendants of the Turks, Albanians, and other people who came down from Turkey in the beginning of the 19th century. It was not until 1880 that you begin to see even the slow rise of any of the native Egyptian population. And wherever you get nationalism coming as late as this, it hits them very hard. I don't blame them at all, but it means that just as a child of disease is all right if you get it as a child, but it's rather bad if you get it when you're later in life. So the Egyptians have got their nationalism very late in life, and so they're blowing off steam. But also going back to Sudan, here nationalism comes to the top, and nationalism so frequently becomes imperialism. First of all, you want to have self-rule, self-determination. Germany must be free, and shortly thereafter we have Leiden's realm. They want to have elbow space. I think that is a clear case here, that Egypt, in addition to being free, wants to have control over another area completely different from her, geographically and ethnologically.
Well, now we're talking about apparently two issues here, the Sudan and the canal. Will you address yourself to those two issues? Are they two issues?
Well, they appear two, but they're really one. As regards to Sudan, I'd like to point out that I differ very strongly from the two speakers here as regards to Sudan being a different geographical area, inhabited by different peoples talking different languages. They're as near to each other, either Sudan and Egypt, as any two regions can be. They depend on one river. They complement each other economically. There has been intermarriage since prehistoric times. The major religion of the Sudan is Islam. Its principal language is Arabic. So if after all this, the Sudan is considered a separate, different region from Egypt, well, I don't understand what we're here for. Secondly, the Sudan has been part of Egypt off and on many parts in history, and certainly when the British came over in 1882. Britain came and found the two regions one political unit. There was a separation. She came in 1899 as a co-administrator of the Sudan. But that gives you an idea how she runs her international agreements. She took the lion's share of that administration. She finally pushed Egypt out of the Sudan. And she's now claiming the right of the Sudanese to determine their fate. Why doesn't she allow Egypt to determine its fate as well? Mr. Nichols?
We get back here, I think, to the thing that I said originally, which is behind so much of this Egyptian problem, or the question, the crisis there, is this desire to get rid of the British from Egyptian soil. Mm. I would like, if I may, therefore, to address myself to the one phase of it, the canal zone and its defense. It would seem to me, I don't think that anyone here wants to claim that he's a military expert, but it would seem to me, in very general terms, that the defense of the canal is involved primarily in connection with air warfare. The Russians could very conceivably mount an attack from within their borders and drop atomic bombs at some future date upon the canal and knock it out. It would seem in those circumstances, therefore, that your actual number of troops required on the canal, be they Egyptian or be they foreign troops, is not great in any circumstances, at least only enough to take care of possible paratroop operations. Now, the results of World War II have left this situation. The British have been pushed to the westward into Libya. They have their bases there. They also have Cyprus directly north of Egypt in the Mediterranean, a very key position. And they also have their bases over in Iraq and in Jordan. In addition to that, both America and Britain have certain commitments and definite arrangements with the Turks, which takes the possible defense of the canal against air attack, which is the important thing. You just can't simply sit with radar scopes on top of the canal and hope to do anything about an attack from Russia. You have got to intercept them if you're going to do anything. Now, the distances here, even so, are relatively short. About 1,500 miles, would you say, to the Russian borders. Now, it seems to me that in this military situation, too much emphasis is being placed upon the need of sitting right, camping right on the canal. And that is why I take the view that some formula should be found, could be found, to get British troops, as such, out of the canal area because of the other bases that they have access to. And in connection with the training of troops to take care of order on the canal and to provide against paratroop depredations of any kind, that is, of course, a question which I should like to hear Professor Salim say something about.
Well, I think one important aspect of the defense of the canal that seems to be overlooked is the fact that defense implies two things. military bases and military armament, and the heart of the people, their cordiality, their friendship to the powers of defense. If by hanging on to the base in the Canal Zone and keeping the British there against the wishes of the people of the area, you are ensuring one thing, which is the military part, you are completely undermining the defense, the real defense of the area, by turning the people hostile to the Western cause. It will be a great pity.
Well, of course, we agree that defense involves those two elements. But at the moment, your case for entrusting it to the Egyptians seems to me rather a weak one. When we look at the instability in the government of Egypt, when we see the appalling riots that occurred in Cairo just a few weeks ago, this does not seem the moment to turn over the defense to the people themselves, without some guarantees for foreign participation.
You see, we're now dealing with the issue, Professor Selene, that concerns the American people most, that the withdrawal of Britain from the Sudan and from the Canal Zone would create a vacuum there into which the Russians would move, militarily and politically. What do you say to that?
I know very well that this issue is of paramount importance, not only to the Western world, but I assure you, to Egypt itself. We have no desire whatever to be rid of the British in order to have the Russians on our back. That would be more than stupid. It would be fatal. What we want is to take our part in the defense of the Middle East, not to be spectators on the sideline and watch others defending us. That is too humiliating a position, and we refuse to stand by it. We want to take our share in the defense of our area, and just as you are helping Western Europe to create a European army, we ask ourselves, why don't you help the Arab nations to create an Arab army?
On that particular point, I think we've come to the crux of the matter from the American point of view. The only thing that America is interested in is law, order, stability, and a means to get through to and through the Suez Canal and other areas in the Near East. What we're trying to do is not to back up the British or to back up the Egyptians, but what can come as a practical solution. To my mind, the thing to do is to have a Middle East command of some sort. I'm perfectly, as far as I'm concerned, this had to be presided over by an Egyptian general. I have no objection whatsoever. But we do want to have a security that the Canal Zone will be and can be defended. And unfortunately, Americans are very skeptical as to the ability of the Egyptians to defend themselves. Egypt is a young nation with a very young military tradition, and her army to date has not proved very satisfactory. The little fighting there, for example, with the Arab nations against Palestine, which the Arab nations in general, more especially Egypt, was ignominiously defeated, has not made America feel that she will rely very much upon the strength of the Egyptian army, as opposed, for example, in Turkey. The Turkish army is an excellent army, we think. They've certainly shown very well both in Turkey and in Korea. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm delighted to bring in the Persians, the Turks, the Egyptians, the Arabs. But I do think there should be either British or American or French or someone there to bring as a nucleus for the training of troops to give them provide stability.
Well, I think the natural way to create a Middle East defense is to get the people of the Middle East themselves to work for that defense and to get them to want to defend their area. The whole trouble is that so far we don't feel that the Middle East belongs to the people of the Middle East. We don't feel that Egypt belongs to the Egyptians. In the last two wars, Egypt helped as much as it could, the Western powers, only to find that afterwards she had herself under British dominion and she was having still the trouble of getting them out. Unless you give people freedom, then they have nothing to fight for.
Do you feel, for example, Professor Selene, that the Iraq belongs to the Iraqis with those British bases there?
Well, I think Britain is coming up for some trouble there. I don't know how long she'll wait, but it's coming up.
Well, if you are in earnest in your desire to participate and even to take a lead in the defense of the area, I don't quite understand why the proposals by Britain, the United States, France, and Turkey, given, I think, on October the 10th for a Middle Eastern command, were rejected by you. The British position has simply been one of holding on to the defensive strength that it has in the Canal Zone until newer and more mutual international arrangements can take their place, yet you rejected those proposals.
I think, of course, if I may put in just a word, yet again comes psychological, the feeling. Actually, there are American troops scattered in England, in France, in Germany, and the rest of it. And the people in France, for the most part, have no objection. They don't bother about them. They welcome them there. The same way the situation, however, in Egypt is owing to their very keen sensitivity, their inferiority complex, as far as it is. They're terrified to have any foreign troops there. And yet, as a matter of fact, I think that it would be very sensible to be an aid and protection to the Egyptian people, for them to join in a Middle East command, and from my point of view, it would be well to have an Egyptian general at the top.
Yes, but the position of foreign troops in a country depends very much on the standing they're having there. The Americans in England and France are there on the invitation, in fact, the insistence of these two countries. I cannot imagine for a moment that they would behave like the British were behaving or are behaving in Egypt now, shooting the French and the British if they want them to leave. That is where the trouble comes in. We have had these British troops, not because of communist danger. They've been there long before communism was heard of, or fascism for that matter. And they are there in spite of our wishes. They're shooting us down, cutting one part of the country away from the other, controlling it as if it's part of Britain herself, and talking at the same time of friendship and of partnership. The two things don't go together.
Well, no one regrets the recent disorders more than the British.
They called them. How can they regret them?
They didn't call them. They were there in the canal zone already. The incidents began. The British had to defend their positions, defend their own people from sniping, looting and the like. That's how the disorders have come about. The real crux of the matter is a matter of method. Both countries agree that the present situation should change. The Egyptians say, take every British soldier out within a year, then we'll make arrangements for defense. The British say, well, concert arrangements for defense, international arrangements preferably first, and then we'll go. That's the crux of the matter.
But we seem to forget that we have been talking with Britain for 5 solid years. This is not a thing that came up last October. We've been discussing and negotiating on the friendliest of bases for 5 years. And if we can't come to an understanding after 5 years, can we be accused of being impatient?
Well, there were negotiations which led to an agreement being initialed in 1946, by which the British would have withdrawn from their wartime positions in Egypt by 1949. That agreement fell to the ground because the Egyptians, at least in a British view, went back on it. And the reason, and the matter on which they went back was this other question of the Sudan. There was a difference in interpretation as to the wording of the agreement in which within the framework of the unity of the two countries under the Egyptian crown, there was to be progress in the Sudan towards self-determination. The Egyptian position was, whatever progress there is towards self-government in the Sudan, it must be under the Egyptian crown. Britain said that, too, must be left to the Sudanese to decide. That was why the earlier agreement failed, and really negotiations were only resumed effectively in 1950.
For 18 months.
Of course, Professor Mowat, there is this to be said. We, as the originators under the Wilson Doctrine of self-determination in many respects, we came in there to, I think you'll agree, to embarrass the British in their empire relations considerably along the line all these years. And this argument might be brought up by the Egyptians, and I think it holds some water, that the British would be kind toward the doctrine of self-determination, so far as the Sudan is concerned at least, if the British were quite sure that the Sudanese would vote their way. Now, is that an overstatement, a little too much prejudice in it, or what?
Well, I think it might have been true 20 years ago. I don't think it's true now. Eden's statement in November specifically said that the Sudanese, now achieving self-government, were completely free to decide, including the question whether they would stay under the Egyptian crown or not. You could certainly argue that in the past Britain has been slow to change its colonial methods. That's not true in the last 20 years. The whole tendency has been toward bringing countries much more rapidly than before to self-government, and the record in India and Burma is a chief example of that.
I think what Mr. Nichols said about Britain's intentions of getting Sudanese to determine themselves on Britain's side do hold water, because here is Britain refusing to accept Egypt's challenge to have a plebiscite immediately, to ask the Sudanese now, under the auspices of the United Nations, how they'd like their country to be arranged. They would like to stay there for a year or two in order to manage to direct public opinion to vote in the way they'd like them to vote.
And Egypt would like Britain to withdraw at once and leave a vacuum in which it could send its agents in to influence the vote. You get a complete deadlock.
Of course, I think one of the main troubles here, to get back to the real issue here, we Americans, as Americans, are interested in seeing what would happen in the immediate future if the British or any other troops withdrew. Would Egypt be able to have a strong and a stable government inside? Would she be able to have a strong and stable army and air corps on the outside? As Mr. Nichols has pointed out, the major defense of the Suez Canal would have to be air. And it seems to me, irrespective of how many land forces there, the major thing is to have a number of very important air bases there, and will Egypt be in a position to put up a strong air defense of the Suez Canal as one? The other is internal stability. In other words, will Egypt be able to have a strong government such as we have at the moment in India, or will Egypt become another Burma, which is simply chaos? Most of us are frightened here that it will be chaos. In other words, the British originally stepped in 1882 because of widespread rioting and disorder in Egypt at that particular time. In the meantime, they have withdrawn from Egypt proper, and Egypt is completely independent. But the recent riots here inside of Cairo these last few weeks show that there's great danger of anarchy and things just falling to pieces. That's the one thing that we're most concerned with.
Well, seeing that these considerations are attached to Egypt, I think I may be permitted to answer. I assure you that Egypt can produce as stable a regime and as stable a government as any in the world. The present trouble we have had is because of the presence of the British, not in spite of it. Once the British are out, we'll have peace and order as we have had for many, many years. As regards our ability to defend the canal by anti-aircraft and by our own air force, we did that in World War II. And the evidence of Lord Wilson and Lord Wavell and the others prove that the Egyptian Air Force and anti-aircraft gun were a great help.
Well, then your cue is to accept the proposals and negotiate over them for a Middle Eastern command.
What then, Professor Salim, would be the Egyptian reaction should a group of the powers, or Britain itself, say this: we agree, we'll get out?
I think we'll be throwing our hats in the air and very much on your side.
What would be your way of implementing the defense of the canal?
We shall certainly come forward with constructive proposals to ask that the canal and the Middle East as a whole should be the responsibility first and foremost of the people of the Middle East, working conjointly and under the auspices of the United Nations.
Where would Western help figure in there?
We shall welcome it as soon as we feel the need for it, which is almost immediately.
What will be the effect, Mr. Salim, of the recent change in government in Egypt?
I think it's giving reason and negotiation its last chance. There's no change on the stand of national demands. There's only a difference in the approach. We are not going out to fight the British and make it awkward for them and for us to live together. We are hoping that the new British government, with a new government in Egypt, will arrange reasonably a solution of this matter.
You haven't precipitated a crisis at a very awkward time in order to embarrass the British.
No, that's been most unfortunate for us. I think the time this crisis came about is most unfavorable for Egypt, but it's just one of those things.
Of course, there I do disagree. I think that the factor of psychological face-saving is great. I'm sorry if I feel that way, but...
No,
I do.
I just want to say that we gave Britain a 12-month warning that this declaration of independence on our part is coming about. And she can't be taken by surprise.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but our time is up. You've been listening to a Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, What's Behind the Egyptian Crisis. We want to thank our guests for today, Leslie Nichols of the WGN News staff, William McGovern, Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University, Charles Mowat, Associate Professor of British History at the University of Chicago, and Hussein Beke Salim, Dean of the Faculty of Commerce at Fuad First University, Cairo, Egypt. We invite you to send for printed copies of today's broadcast, complete with a list of books and articles about the subject discussed. Copies are available for 10 cents in coin, or you may want to subscribe to the Reviewing Stand at a cost of only $1 for the next 4 months, $2.50 for an entire year. These rates will remain in effect until February 15th, after which they will be raised. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Now, our moderator, James H. McBurney, will tell you about next week's program.
Next week, the Reviewing Stand will discuss the question, what should our children read? With us will be Mrs. Margaret Friske, editor of the Children's Press in Chicago, Leverett Gleason, a New York City publisher of comic magazines, Mrs. Dilla McBean, director of the Division of Libraries in the Chicago Public Schools, and Professor Paul Witte of the School of Education at Northwestern University. We hope you will join us next week as we probe this interesting and, we think, important question, what should our children read?
The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast every week as a public service feature of Mutual. Your announcer, Jerry Coffer. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.